Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Mark Johnson, author of Political Hellraiser, The Life and Times of Senator Burton K. Wheeler of Montana. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. While not a household name, Burton K. Wheeler may have been the most powerful politician Montana ever produced. And he was one of the most influential and controversial members of the United States Senate. A New Deal Democrat and lifelong opponent of concentrated power, he consistently acted with a righteous personal and political independence that has all but disappeared from the public sphere. In his book, Political Hellraiser, author Mark Johnson provides a fascinating portrait of Senator Wheeler, a political force whose successes and failures were woven into the fabric of 20th century America. Mark Johnson has worked as a broadcast journalist, communications and crisis management consultant, and served as a top aide to Idaho's longest-serving governor, Cecil D. Andrus. His writings in politics and history, published in the New York Times and the California Journal of Politics and Policy. He also manages a blog and podcast called Many Things Considered. Mark Johnson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you, Bob. What a delight to have an opportunity to visit with you.
In a sense, you're back at Reader's Corner, because once upon a time, you actually did one of these for me, as I remember.
I think maybe on a couple of different occasions,
yeah,
you were reckless enough to turn the microphone over to me.
Well, you did a great job and an even better job on this book. I mean, I am just so excited to read about someone I must admit I knew nothing about. And I think it's fair to say that a good number of our listeners are probably in the same boat. Yeah. So let's start off with, how did this come about? Where did you find Burton K. Wheeler? Were you the kid growing up in Montana that was in Montana history class and forever fascinated by him?
Not exactly, but I have always been interested in this period between the world wars. Uh-huh. And I'd read a number of Senate biographies of prominent senators in that period, including the biography of Tom Walsh, who was a very important senator from Montana in the 20s and 30s. And in the Walsh biography, Wheeler keeps coming up over and over again because Walsh essentially was his mentor. And I thought, well, I got to go looking for the Wheeler biography, and it had never been written. Mm-hmm. So I launched on that project close to 20 years ago, I guess.
Wow.
Set it aside for a period of time while I was working full-time. And then once able to reinvent myself in semi-retirement, I got back to it in a big way. So that's how it came about.
Well, let's go back to that intro that I introduced Senator Wheeler, and let's focus on this bit of how independent he was. I mean, most people today in politics, when they think of a Republican or a Democrat United States senator who's independent, they probably are talking about somebody who crossed the aisle a few times to vote for a bill that was an opposition bill. But this guy was way beyond that, to the point of endorsing people from other parties.
Right. Well, Wheeler certainly identified all throughout his life as a Democrat, but he was really an independent. And as you mentioned, he did not only make common cause with people across the political aisle, including the famous senator from Idaho in that period, William Borah, but he actually publicly endorsed Republicans repeatedly throughout his career, Borah included. Famous story in 1936, Democratic National Committee put out the word that it's going to challenge Borah's reelection in Idaho. And by that time, of course, Borah was the lion of the Senate, well established. Wheeler says publicly, if the Democrats go after Senator Borah, I'll go to Idaho and campaign for him. So it's like unbelievable today in our political environment to have that kind of political independence.
Well, in order to pull that off, you have to have an incredible base of power, of political power in your home state. Help us understand how in his early career he mustered that political power that he would be able to use later on in his job as a U.S. senator.
Well, I think he came up through the school of political hard knocks, suffered any number of setbacks in his early political career, a one-term state legislator, forced out of office as U.S. attorney in Montana during the World War I period, primarily because he stood up against the prevailing sentiment that cracked down on civil liberties and free speech, and the idea that you could actually dissent against the government was not accepted in any way, shape, or form. He resisted all of that, cost him his job. He was humiliated in a 1920 election for governor in Montana and then remarkably comes back 2 years later to win a Senate seat the first of four times. So, yeah, he terribly ambitious guy, I think, as most politicians, successful politicians are. Mm-hmm. You have to have that fire in your belly, and he certainly did. But he always was, I think, was looking for a way to broaden his base, if you will, to find new allies, whether they're Democrats or Republicans or socialists or whoever they might be, that you could make common cause with. So he built, by the late 1930s, early 1940s, Wheeler had created a true bipartisan political machine in Montana, a partnership with the Republican governor at that time. He had a remarkable ability to appeal across the political spectrum.
And in his younger years, he had to confront Anaconda Mining because Anaconda, which I learned in your book, I didn't quite understand, literally ran the state to the point where they were appointing U.S. senators. I mean, that is to say that you had to get the approval of Anaconda to do it. Could you walk us through that? I mean, that's an amazing part of the story.
It's probably as good an example as there is in American political history of one state being completely dominated by a corporate entity. Anaconda had control over most of the mines in Butte, copper mines, big smelters in Anaconda and Great Falls, vast timberland holdings. Montana Power Company was created as a result of Anaconda needing to supply electricity to its various operations. Then they wound up owning most of the daily newspapers in the state. So it's almost like a corporate colony in the early part of the 20th century, probably up until 1940 or so. And Anaconda is a huge multinational company with interests in South America, all over the Western Hemisphere. And they truly did dominate the economy and the politics of the state. And Wheeler started out thinking that he could be his own agent, so to speak, in the political world, and quickly found that if you didn't toe the line with Anaconda, you were going to be in trouble electorally and punished for it. And he was consequently a one-term state legislator.
There was a union organizer who came into Montana to organize the miners who was murdered. I think his name was Little.
Frank Little.
Yep. Right. Frank Little. What role did that play in a sense crystallizing in Wheeler's mind in his eventual campaign, how he would approach concentrated power, this independence we talked about before, whatever?
Well, Frank Little was a true radical, an IWW organizer, Industrial Workers of the World, the one big union. He comes to Butte in the summer of 1917 in the wake of a terrible mine disaster that took the lives of 160-some miners and all of the turmoil that's been whipped up about the U.S. entry into World War I. Opposition to the draft is widespread in Montana. So he comes into Butte and holds a series of rallies, if you will, or speeches to the miners, where he criticizes the war effort. He's trying to recruit miners, obviously, to the IWW cause. But in the middle of the night, he is abducted from a boarding house in Uptown Butte, tortured, and probably was dead by the time he was hung from a railroad trestle at the outside of town. And it was all done as a warning to other agitators, dissenters against the war effort and against the corporate interests in Montana, that this is the fate that awaits you. I think it was the crystallizing moment in Wheeler's political career, kind of bringing together the whole idea of his lifelong defense of civil liberties, free speech. He didn't agree necessarily with everything Frank Little was saying, but he certainly defended his right to say it. And it crystallized his notion about being anti-war and anti-imperialist, the idea that the United States should not be looking to export democracy at the point of a bayonet, if you will, around the world. And I think that 1917 event was the crystallizing moment in his political career.
Did that also contribute then to his much later stances against intervention on the part of the U.S.? I mean, and we'll talk about it in a minute, but obviously toward the end of his career, he took it a bit far, you might say. But tell us how that started, that he became such an anti-interventionist and anti-war.
Well, I think it was a function of that World War I experience in mm-hmm. Montana, and I think a fairly widespread American belief right after World War I that the United States could well have avoided that war with better strategic thinking, if you will, and a real resentment almost that the United States had become involved in this European war. And you have to remember, Wheeler's political base was Butte and Silver Bow County, which had a very large and still does Irish-American population. And the Irish weren't terribly interested in, as they saw, fighting a war against Germany to defend the British Empire. So he came by that anti-war sentiment also in part because his mother was Quaker, and he had some early grounding, I think, in that sort of pacifist anti-war sentiment. But yeah, he wasn't a pacifist in the sense that he didn't believe the United States ought to have a military or be prepared to defend itself, but he certainly was opposed to the United States going looking for opportunities to use military power.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Mark Johnson, author of the book Political Hellraiser, The Life and Times of Senator Burton K. Wheeler of Montana. I don't know whether you used the term yourself or whether you quoted somebody, but it was like he said he was a peace progressive, or somebody called him a peace progressive. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting term I hadn't heard before.
One historian has lumped Bora and Robert La Follette from Wisconsin, Hiram Johnson from California, Wheeler in that group of progressives who shared political views about concentrated power and anti-monopoly and that sort of thing, championing organized labor, but also very much opposed to a U.S. form of imperialism, which they saw, particularly in the post-World War I era, as the United States becoming its own empire, emulating the British Empire, which none of those peace progressives would have been in favor of.
Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is that it is indeed a walk through history, the first half of 20th century American history. And I learned so much that I thought I knew in my American history class in high school and college. But of course, in those days, I wasn't nearly as interested as I am today. But learning it all through the eyes of this one guy and what he managed to pull off. So let's just take a few of the episodes through history that we've all read about, we know about, but never heard a word about Burton K. Wheeler.
Right.
And the one that jumps out on me right away is FDR. He's in his first term. The Supreme Court is knocking down all of his legislation, and he decides, well, there's an easy way out of this. I just need to expand the size of the Supreme Court, which became known as the court packing plan of FDR. Now, I always knew, of course, that that was defeated, but I never really understood Burton K. Wheeler's role in that.
Well, Wheeler almost immediately decided that Roosevelt had made a huge political blunder and vast overreach, expanding the power of the presidency, something that he resisted all throughout his political career. And I guess the part of it that I find so fascinating is he didn't just oppose the president of his own party, he led the opposition in the Senate. And a very effective leader he was in terms of putting together a bipartisan coalition with Bora from Idaho leading the Republican side. But yeah, a remarkable story. You know, Roosevelt wins a landslide reelection in 1936 and brings into office a slew of Democrats into Congress, 76 Democrats in the Senate, and several others who are identified as farmer labor progressives who voted with the Democrats. So he's basically got 79 or 80 votes in the Senate going in, supposedly able to support anything that the president proposes.
And Wheeler was one of the first to endorse Roosevelt in the campaign,
right? He was absolutely the first senator to endorse him in 1930, even before Roosevelt had sought a second term as governor of New York. So this is a true case, I think, of a politician putting what he saw as the country's interests ahead of his party's interest. And at some political peril to Wheeler's standing in Montana, Roosevelt very popular in Montana, organized labor very much in the president's corner. So he suffered some political damage from taking what I think was a very courageous and maybe ultimately the most important thing he did in terms of protecting the idea of an independent Supreme Court that couldn't be dominated just because the president has such overwhelming majorities in Congress.
So on the lighter side, and we'll probably get back to one or two examples of more serious stuff, but on the lighter side, something I had no idea, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. If I hadn't read your book, I never would have known that the Jimmy Stewart movie that I probably saw a half dozen times when I was a lot younger was in fact built on some aspects of Burton K. Wheeler's life, and tell us about the celebration in D.C. that followed that.
Well, the movie came out in 1939. It's still one of Frank Capra's classic right. American stories about the idealistic young senator from the West who takes on the power of Washington, D.C. Filibuster scene is a famous scene in movie history. Grand premiere is held in Washington, D.C. The Washington Press Club actually sponsored the premiere of the movie. And pretty much everybody who was anybody in Washington turns out to see this celebrated motion picture. And official Washington absolutely hated it. Wheeler and his wife, Lulu, who was an influential Washington hostess, and their youngest daughter is invited by the director, Frank Capra, to sit with him in their box at the premiere. And they stuck it out to the end, although, according to Capra's telling, a third of the audience walked out before the movie sputtered to an end. So it was very controversial and was officially denounced by Alvin Barkley, who was the Senate Majority Leader, as, you know, an affront to the Senate that this couldn't possibly represent how the Senate really operates.
That's a great story. I just love it. So let's get back to a little bit of history here. None other than J. Edgar Hoover and Burton K. Wheeler butting heads. And I believe there's a part here in your tale where Wheeler may have had a chance to move on J. Edgar Hoover at one of his weakest moments, maybe one of very few weak moments Hoover ever had, but he passed on it. Help us with that.
Right after the 1932 election, Roosevelt's election, Wheeler's invited to Warm Springs, Georgia, to consult with the president on the makeup of his cabinet and various things. And during the course of that conversation, FDR asked Wheeler what he thought of this guy, Hoover, who's running the FBI. And Wheeler certainly knew of Hoover, dating back to his own run-in with the FBI in the early 20s. And he said to Roosevelt, well, I have no real reason to think that he's not doing an okay job. And but he could have had the opportunity, it seems to me, to kind of give the thumbs down to J. Edgar Hoover, continuing as the director of the FBI. And I, you know, it's one of those great what-ifs in history. What if J. Edgar Hoover would have been tossed out by FDR in 1933 instead of staying into what the 60s or early 70s yeah. as the director of the FBI, with all that we know now about his abuse of that position in many mm-hmm. ways?
Well, another great part of your book is the story behind the Teapot Dome scandal. I think every kid in American history had at least a day where they focused on the Teapot Dome right. scandal. But again, who would have known that a very unusual set of circumstances where minority Democrats kind of take this issue on, and this guy's one of them?
Well, it says something about the way the Senate once was and no longer is, that you could have these members of the Senate in the minority party who had particular skill or expertise in pursuing investigations actually put in charge of investigating Republican administrations. So you have these two Democrats from Montana, Wheeler investigating the Justice Department and the Attorney General, almost simultaneously with his Democratic colleague from Montana, Tom Walsh, investigating this what we now know as the Teapot Dome scandal, which eventually sent the Secretary of the Interior to jail. A remarkable moment in Senate history, these two senators from a small western state that lead arguably two of the most sensational and far-reaching investigations in the history of the Senate.
And just recently you wrote a column, maybe you remember the name of it, I don't, but in which you compared this particular approach that Wheeler and his colleagues took to, well, one could say, what isn't happening today in Washington.
Right. I think I titled it Dereliction of Duty.
That's right, Dereliction of Duty. Yeah, that was a great title.
Well, one of the things that I think is fascinating about Wheeler's career is that he was what I call a Senate institutionalist. He believed in the power inherent in the Senate to be a check on executive activity, the expansion of the executive power. And he, over and over in his career, used the power of being a United States senator to provide that kind of oversight and that kind of check on executive power. So the analysis I was providing was, you know, in 1924 and 25, You have a Republican Senate that investigated a Republican administration and attorney general, forcing the resignation of the attorney general. Ultimately, he stands trial, forcing the resignation of the interior secretary, and he goes to jail. The kind of oversight that I think the founders envisioned for the Senate to conduct, and now Republican Senate very reluctant or unwilling completely to investigate the Trump administration on any number of things.
Right. Yeah. They
act like investigation, Bob, but just sort of routine oversight.
Right.
You know, having hearings to illuminate the public record, even about foreign policy or whatever the issue might be.
They're acting like defense counsel for the president in a system of government, which, as the basic student of 101 American politics knows, is three co-equal branches of government.
Right. And B.K. Wheeler was a believer that, for example, the Senate has a responsibility to shape American foreign policy, not just turn that responsibility over to the executive branch. And that United States senators had to be engaged in the broad sweep of American foreign policy in order to adequately represent their constituents, something he did again. He never served on a foreign relations committee, but he had a very influential voice on foreign policy.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Mark Johnson, author of the book Political Hellraiser. The book tells the story of Senator Burton K. Wheeler, one of the most powerful and controversial legislators to come out of Montana. So let's go to World War II, the American debate prior to entering the war, before Pearl Harbor. There was considerable opposition across the country. People were very suspicious of FDR. Wheeler was suspicious of FDR. And he really became an America Firster, or at least part of this movement. At one point, I think you describe an event at Madison Square Garden where he was up there with Lindbergh. To what extent does that bring him down? I mean, by 1946, he loses an election to the U.S. Senate. But help us understand what's going on in these days when Wheeler can't give up on this anti-interventionist thing, even when it's trying to go after Hitler in this case.
Well, yeah. And this is the controversy that still attaches to Wheeler's name because of that period right before Pearl Harbor. And America First is a broad-based grassroots organization, 850,000 members at its peak, probably 450 chapters around the country. And Wheeler becomes really the chief spokesman for this movement, which was not, as it's sometimes portrayed, as being anti-militaristic. What they really advocated was a defense adequate to protect the United States and the Western Hemisphere, but not adequate to engage in another world war. Wheeler's point of view was that Roosevelt was consistently maneuvering public opinion to try to convince the American people that the United States had to become more and more involved in the European struggle. And by the summer of 1940, when Roosevelt is nominated for a third term, you know, France has fallen, the Brits are holding on by their fingernails, and yet the anti-war sentiment in the country is pretty strong. Most people did not want to see Great Britain lose the war to the Nazis, but by the same token, they didn't want to see an American expeditionary force sent to Europe as it had been in 1918. So he stands condemned in my mind and in the minds of most historians of that period for not recognizing the extent of the Nazi threat. And had he had his way, and I think I make this point in the book, had he had his way, you might well have seen Western Europe dominated by Nazi Germany for decades after the Brits presumably have to capitulate. So it is a difficult period of his political career, based, I think, upon some faulty logic, but also based upon his belief, with some justification, that Franklin Roosevelt was not really leveling with the American people about the direction that he thought ultimately the country would have to go.
Mm-hmm. But where he may have been right as far as his criticism of FDR was in his thoughts about the Yalta Conference.
Yes, and critical throughout World War II of many aspects of Roosevelt's foreign policy and war strategy. He opposed the unconditional surrender policy of the Allies. He believed that the United States ought to concentrate on beating Japan in the Pacific before worrying about Germany in Europe. And very critical in the post-war period about what Wheeler comes to believe is going to be Soviet domination now, at least of Eastern Europe. So, yeah, the other thing that I do give him credit for, as much as I can find fault with some of his positions, was that in that period of 1940 and 41, we had a huge debate in this country, maybe the greatest foreign policy debate in the history of the country, about the broad direction of American foreign policy. Is the United States going to be a world power, in essence, be a superpower? And that debate raged for months and months in 1940 and 41. And I give Wheeler some credit for at least stimulating that debate, because every step of the way there was a congressional discussion, hearings, floor debates on just what would be the direction of American foreign policy. Frankly, we've not had that kind of debate since, in my judgment, right, since 1941.
For sure. So right smack dab in the middle of that Second World War, or I guess toward the beginning of it, FDR interns the Japanese Americans on the West Coast. And you cover that briefly in your book, but it appears as though, as independent as he was and as much of a free thinker as he was, on that one he was a bit on the timid side.
I think that is universally the case. I'm not aware of any politician who really aggressively pushed back against that Japanese internment policy, which we now recognize as one of the great affronts to civil liberties in American history.
Yeah. So when he's defeated in 1946, I couldn't believe I'm reading along about this Erickson who beats him, and all of a sudden Ronald Reagan's name pops up. I mean, you managed to get Jimmy Stewart in your book. You managed to get Ronald Reagan. Anyway, tell us about what Reagan was up to in those days. That was long before he was the conservative governor of California, I think.
Yeah, he was. Reagan was involved, along with a lot of other Hollywood luminaries at the time, in a political action movement in, you know, Hollywood based, that was quite liberal. And they targeted Wheeler for defeat, largely because of his position on foreign policy prior to World War II and during the war. Mm-hmm. And so by 1946, when Wheeler's running for a fifth term, he's really angered his political base in Montana. He's lost touch with sort of the rank and file Democrats. And this group that Reagan is a part of, including President Roosevelt's son, James Roosevelt, actually come into Montana, spend some money, do some radio speeches, that sort of thing, targeting Wheeler in what must have been a brutal, brutal campaign, one that he did not take seriously enough, in my judgment, until it was probably a foregone conclusion that he was going to lose.
So Harry Truman was a U.S. senator with Burton K. Wheeler.
They were very close. Truman came to the Senate in 1934, joined Wheeler's committee, which Wheeler eventually came to chair, the Senate Interstate Commerce Committee, it was called at that time. And they became very close friends and remained close friends long after both of them were out of political office. Truman was one of the first to make a condolence call to Senator Wheeler when his wife passed away. So, yeah, they did not agree on foreign policy, but were close personal friends.
Mm-hmm. So after,
which is one of the things that's so amazing, Bob, about Wheeler. He had this range of relationships from Huey Long on the populist political left to William Borah and the La Follettes on the progressive right. He voted for Norman Thomas, the Socialist Party presidential candidate in 1940. So he has this amazing range of political relationships that, again, quite unusual in today's climate.
Well, the system doesn't seem to allow for it anymore.
Well, I think that's really true. And I don't know what exactly has changed, but it's become more it's certainly become more difficult or less likely that a politician of that level of prominence mm-hmm. can exercise that kind of independence and that kind of be their own man, if you will.
You can't read the life and career of Burton K. Wheeler that you have dealt with in your book here without coming away wishing that some of this was still with us, that a guy like Wheeler isn't in the U.S. Senate today, and that the system doesn't allow for the kind of independence that that we see in this guy. As you're writing this book, did you know where this was going in the sense that This is more than just a biography of one guy who happened to be a Montana U.S. senator for a long time. It's also a little bit of a message about what we've lost. And the next question is how to get it back.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to your question is no, I didn't know that's exactly where it was going to end up. I thought at one level it was just a good political yarn. Yeah. And a fascinating character, controversial but also consequential. But by the time I really started to deal with his legacy, which I do believe is a legacy of independence, being an institutionalist, protecting the Senate's prerogatives, someone who's willing to put his party behind his country, put his country ahead of his party. And that is sadly not the standard anymore and something that we have lost for whatever reason. We've divided up into these partisan tribes where both parties seem totally intent on appealing just to their political base, not trying to find any middle ground on anything. So it is lamentable, and it's I think it's, you know, really destructive to the democratic mm-hmm. process because, you know, from your political background, Bob, you know that most important issues get solved in the middle, and they don't get solved in one fell swoop. They get right. pecked away at, and you make a little progress, and then you back up, and you make a little more progress. But it requires contribution from both sides and accommodation in the middle. Compromise.
Right.
Shouldn't be a dirty word.
So you just came off a tour of Montana talking about your book. I'm from the Midwest, so I'm not surprised that I didn't know anything about Burton K. Wheeler. But do Montanans know? I mean, if you move around the state, is Wheeler a name like Bora in Idaho that people are, oh, yeah, Burton K. Wheeler?
Well, yes and no. I mean, he is commemorated and remembered in Montana. There's a bust in the state capitol building in Helena. There's a Wheeler Center at Montana State University that some of his friends and family endowed some years ago, much like the Andrus Center at Boise State. Mm-hmm. But for a younger generation, no, not yeah. so much.
Yeah.
But he certainly is remembered in Butte, Montana, because that was his political base, and had a wonderful opportunity to talk at a wonderful archive of the Butte mining experience. And people had firsthand accounts. Some people had firsthand accounts of knowing him or knowing members of his yeah. family. So it is he is remembered to that extent.
Well, let's hope this is required reading for Montana State history students over the years, but it certainly ought to be required reading for Reader's Corner listeners, and this is a fascinating look at American history through the career and life of one man. But what a job you've done, Mark. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us at Reader's Corner.
Very kind of you, Bob. Wonderful to be with you.
Join us next week as we talk to Lindsay Hilsum about her book, In Extremis, The Life and Death of the war correspondent Marie Colvin. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.